This is the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. TNT.
Good morning and welcome to the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT, a week in which many believe we are on the verge of World War III. Over the weekend, of course, that prospect heightened as conflict intensified between Iran and Israel, and the British government sent RAF jets to support Israel, as British politicians are openly stating now that the UK is involved in the Middle East conflict. But we didn't vote for this, did we? What does this mean for our world and how will it impact the UK? I'll be discussing this later with TNT's Basil Valentine, our political editor, and Gemma Cooper will be joining me as usual to discuss how this is all playing out in the mainstream. I'll also be joined today by journalist Paula Jardine. She'll be revealing the key players behind the UK's lockdown. Also, commentator Geoffrey Peel will be here. He'll be talking about the events in the Middle East and how this is impacting Labour and becoming something of an Achilles heel for them via George Galloway. And we're joined by the world's most cancelled comedian, apparently. More, all of that and more, of course, as we progress over the next 2 hours. Do not go anywhere. I hope that this finds you well. I know it's a difficult time at the moment. It's very unsettling out there. There's a great deal of fear that is being whipped up, but hopefully over the next 2 hours, we'll be able to put that into some context and find a place for it all. Now, we Brits, we do love to talk about our weather, don't we? Now, I'd like to talk about the state of the skies over the UK on Saturday. This weekend, the forecast was apparently supposed to be glorious sunshine. And it was to a degree, but by Saturday afternoon, the UK sky looked as if someone had been particularly industrious with a bottle of Tippex. I saw it with my own eyes and I know it's neither normal or healthy. Our sky was a whitened out toxic mess. I have received pictures from people in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, parts of the UK, including Cornwall, Wiltshire and Kent. They told the same story, that of an enhanced and whitened sky with extensive crisscrossing that many people understand to be geoengineering. Now, I appreciate that this topic is a tricky one. Geoengineering, the manipulation of our weather, is one of those subjects that people are ridiculed for talking about. I've heard it all, and for over a decade, I have interviewed many people to better inform myself on the subject. I've talked with pilots who say there is no such thing as chemtrails. They say they are contrails, which is the exhaust fumes that form from aircraft and leave trails in the sky. I've also talked with insiders and researchers who point me to known literature on the subject, including one acknowledged historic experiment with UK geoengineering in the 1950s, and which was documented in a BBC play, or it's a Radio 4 programme, actually. It took place in Lynmouth, a village in Devon, in 1952. It was alleged that a rainmaking experiment, aka geoengineering, had taken place and was ultimately to blame for a landslide that killed 30 people on 15th of August 1952. What we do know for fact is classified government files eventually released to the public confirm that these experiments did indeed take place. But it's not as if the British government is trying to hide it. Geoengineering is all over the government website. In 2010, the British government admitted to geoengineering data when it set out to both define and to regulate geoengineering in accord with framework laid down by the UN and in line with the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. The 2010 report recommended, in quotes, that the government review its policy on geoengineering to give it greater priority. Then we should not forget the document from the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy about greenhouse gas removal, aka geoengineering. This clearly sets out the UK government's position on what can be done to counteract man-made climate change in line with the Paris Agreement. Now, this is a subject I've long been interested in, and there is a great deal of evidence to suggest that our skies have indeed changed, and in formation all across the UK at the same time. If it was simply contrails, e.g. the expected emissions from a plane, it would happen daily, but it does not. We have every right to ask questions about what is happening in our skies, and we have every right to receive straightforward answers. A more recent Freedom of Information request asked about cloud seeding. This is a troubling term for the UK government, and they do everything they can to avoid discussion about it. This leads them into areas such as aerosol spraying and wider agendas. But the fact is, no matter what skeptics say, something has changed. People need to be looking up and asking what it is. We need to be able to ask questions and debate it without fear of being called a conspiracy theorist for a subject that is long past its sell-by date to be discussed. We will be tackling this topic in more depth as we move forward. And on that note, let's find out what Gemma Cooper has to say about the UK headlines.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I come to you for facts. I really appreciate what you and your team do.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And good morning, Gemma Cooper. How are we as we start this week?
Well, I'm a little under the weather, Sonia, today. And I wonder if it's because of what went on in the skies over the weekend. I mean, I saw it as much as anyone. I live by the coast. I woke up on Saturday morning. I was like, oh, what a beautiful day. And the first thing I saw after I thinking, what a beautiful day, I turned over, looked out the window in my bedroom, and there was a big white stripe going down the sky. And I thought, oh, here we go, something afoot. And even if, right, let's just, because we have to remain balanced on this show.
Always.
You know, even if they're say they are, right? I mean, I'm not going to get involved in this massive subject in 2 minutes we have before we discuss the other big headline, which is war. Even if they are contrails, they're having the same effect. You know, 1 minute it's beautiful blue skies and it's great sunbathing weather and we can all be out. And then a few hours later, blanket grey cloud blocking the energy of the sun and you can feel the change in the mood. So whatever it is, it's having that effect. Of the natural progression of the year, which is we come out of hibernation in the winter, vitamin D levels are low. Vitamin D plays a massive part in immunity, as we know. And that whole point is to get out in the sunshine. That's why spring makes us feel so good. Summer's on the way. We're not in touch with who we are because of whatever is going on in the skies. Whatever it is having that effect. You know, we talked about it with the eclipse. As soon as you feel the sun's energy going, you physically feel it. It doesn't feel right.
Absolutely.
So I'll leave it there with that one. Maybe that's why I'm not feeling so well today. You know, I've got the sniffles because I didn't get my vitamin D at the weekend. Could be.
Could well be. Well, let's wish Gemma well again. You're not the only one, by the way, who has reported to me this morning that they are feeling under the weather. There's a reason we use that expression, you know. Right, Gemma, what's going on in the UK?
Oh, well, what's going on in the UK is the same as what's going on globally. It's war, isn't it? It's the, you know, I don't know if you remember, Sonia, and if you're in the chat, I'd like to hear the opinions. But do you remember back in the 1990s, there was a program in the UK and it was called The Day to Day. And it was a spoof satire about the mainstream media. And what does the mainstream media love more than anything else? And it was illustrated perfectly on The Day to Day. You could probably watch it on YouTube. And they had this big thing where it was war, and they changed the set in the studio and they had all these new graphics, and it was like, you know, the mainstream media loves war. It's an editorial wet dream, you know. The images, they're like video games. You'll get all the politicians come out of the woodwork, they all want to speak about it. Will it escalate, will it not, the drama, forgetting what this one potentially means. Now, we've had dodgy Dave Cameron, our foreign secretary, has come out in the last 40 minutes. He's been speaking. He says the last thing we want is escalation. So of course everyone's piling on to stop escalation. So, you know, we had Rishi Sunak yesterday saying we had to include RAF fighter typhoon jets to stop war. We had to go in and wade in and pile in to stop war. We had to escalate to de-escalate. No, it's very kind of gaslighting here. You know, we have to participate to stop it getting any worse. Well, it doesn't add up, does it? So he's been on a few mainstream outlets this morning saying Iran's attacks were total failures. And that's what our involvement was all about. Let's just take it as a win and concentrate on Hamas. Also, though, this morning, we've had the spokesperson for the Israeli embassy in London saying that Israel will absolutely retaliate. So you've got two conflicting messages there. So the whole kind of coverage with this is essentially gaslighting. Who do you, you know, you're getting one message, then you're getting another message. And also, if you think back 4 years ago, we were under a global fear-based mind control experiment called the Plandemic. what is this looking like it could be? A global fear-based mind control experiment? Because when you are under the threat of global thermal nuclear war, you're very easy to control. And if we have another lockdown based on war, people will do it. People will do it. Nobody wants to be blown to smithereens. So I'm very taking a big step back with this. And I know you've got Basil Valentine, TNT's political editor, on to discuss the more kind of nuanced political aspects of this. But just let's all take a step back. What is this? This is global. What was it 4 years ago? It was global. It was a fear-based experiment where they tried to control the whole human race. Didn't quite work. Nuclear war, we've all been primed for this. This could work. This could be another way of corralling us into behaving in a certain way. So I'm watching with interest, Sonia, and I'll be very interested to hear your take. But in the meantime, the mainstream media, it's war. Oh, I mean, it's a satire spoof, except it's not funny.
It's not. And I really like that advice about taking a step backwards. We absolutely do know from having been in the mainstream that this is box office, right? And that is the reality. They love it. I've seen editors jump up and down at the prospect of fighting, because it's like, okay, that's the front page sorted for tomorrow. And these are the realities that people have to understand, that to a certain degree, there's almost two wars that take place, that which really happens and that which is manufactured and confected and designed to propagandize a situation in order to benefit one side or another. And I'm very much looking forward to Basil's analysis of this to get some understanding, some more in-depth understanding, because I simply don't trust mainstream coverage, Gemma, and neither should we. And I've listened to plenty this morning from Sky to ITV to see what they're all saying. And honestly, it is exactly the same thing. This is war, and that troubles me.
Absolutely. And it's a very easy rhetoric to jump on, isn't it? War. And everybody will be on tenterhooks. Like you said at the start, a very measured editorial, you know, it's not a laughing matter at all. But you're quite right with, in terms of editorial, the editors don't have to stress about what they're going to lead on, whether it be broadcast media, social media, print media, television media, radio media. There's your story. And that's what editors always worry about. It's what journalists always worry about. What's the story today? Have we got a story? Can we lead on this? Well, you can lead on war forever. And I expect the pages to be dominated by this for this week, the coming months, you know, because this attack has happened. So, of course, everybody's thinking, well, what's going to happen next? And of course, the eyes of the world are on Israel. What will they do? Even though our foreign secretary, unelected, is saying it was a failure. Don't worry about it. Israel is saying, no, we will worry about it. So all these conflicting messages, too, you know, that is gaslighting. It will have an effect on the global consciousness. And individual consciousness, and it will lead to fear. Of course, it will lead to fear. Remember the 1980s, the threat of the Cold War, Russia and America, we were all cowering under our beds almost, being pre-primed. It was on the television, documentaries, dramas, films about nuclear war. So it's gone in. It's gone into our psyche already. And everybody obviously is worried that escalation in this instance will mean that. And I just think it's got a lot of parallels with the last 4 years, or 4 years ago, should I say, this sinister threat, you know, which is around every corner, you know, act like you've got it, even when you haven't got it, treat everyone as though they've got it. You know, this is similar. It's similar in the effect it will have on us. All we can do is try and maintain a watchful, mocking distance of these headlines and see them for what they are, drama designed to get you to react instead of act and think and pause before you act. Try not to get sucked in. I say that myself as a former mainstream person instead of journalist now, but if we get too sucked in, we feed it. And that's all I'll say with that one. There are a few other headlines kicking around today, and one of them's quite a positive one, but I'll bring that in the next hour so that we can all have a bit of balance and think, oh, maybe life does go on after all. But yeah, war, not good.
We're in a tricky position, aren't we, at TNT? Because on the one hand, we have to watch what the mainstream is saying, so we have to be able to counteract it. But on the other, as you say, we have to be careful not to get sucked in by it as well, because obviously the mainstream, they determine what the agenda of the day is going to be, and they will focus everybody's energy on that with such intent that it's almost impossible to ignore it. So I think these are all necessary questions. Is exactly what this show is about, and that is questioning the status quo. So Gemma, I really welcome you introing with that, and actually on a slightly different tone to what everybody else is saying, because again, that is exactly what people expect from this show, for us to be able to look at situations in a slightly different way because of our experiences. So I really welcome that. Thank you. And I hope that by the next hour, Gemma, you're feeling altogether a bit better. The time will have worn on a little bit. Get plenty of warm water and lemonade down you, girl. And we will see Gemma in the next hour. We'll be right back.
TNT's David Curtin.
These draconian laws which are being imposed on society simply cannot be policed, and that they will just act on their own volition to stop investigating these things. But they have instruction from the SNP government in Scotland that they must investigate every single complaint that is made under this new law, and it simply is not possible to do so. Now, where the people of Scotland have been so good here is that they are filing all kinds of complaints which are completely ridiculous under normal circumstances, but this is an act of resistance. It is an act of defiance to make people realise that this kind of tyrannical law cannot be implemented and it cannot be sustained.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mama a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, great idea.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local. I can send you with the link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Now, the ongoing COVID inquiry may have no interest in the efficacy of the lockdowns, but one person who has is a journalist, Paula Jardine. She joins me now to discuss her three-part expose in The Conservative Woman and how lockdowns came into force during the pandemic and the man behind them. Welcome, Paula. Thank you for joining us this morning on today's News Talk.
Good to be here. Thank you, Sonia.
Really great to have you with us. Excellent, excellent series of articles, Paula. Thank you for doing them. Very informative indeed. So for our international viewers, explain who Dominic Cummings was, or rather is, because he's not dead.
No, he's out there somewhere. Scuttled off into the sidelines. I think he's with a think tank on something now. But he was Boris Johnson's senior advisor when he became Prime Minister, and he came to national prominence really over his role in the Brexit vote leave campaign, and I guess you'd describe him as the bus that Boris rode into town on. So the two of them were kind of a symbiotic relationship, I would say, and arguably, Boris wouldn't have been Prime Minister without Dominic and everything that he did with Vote Leave. Once Boris became Prime Minister, Dominic was in a position to be more influential than he'd ever been before in government. So he'd previously worked for Michael Gove, when he was Education Secretary. Previous Prime Minister David Cameron had once described him as a career psychopath and had refused to allow him to be employed in any capacity in his government. So he was quite a controversial and polarizing figure. And suddenly in 2020, when all of this kicked off, he was as close as he's ever been to the center of power and in a position to start implementing some of his pet projects, because they were his reward for having delivered on Brexit.
And there's that very famous picture, isn't there, of him and Boris Johnson and Carrie Johnson. And that was on the night of the election when, but literally, we've got it on the screen now. Boris Johnson had just realised at that point that he had won, secured the election and was going to be Prime Minister. And there is Dominic Cummings in the background. And Dominic Cummings came from an interesting background himself, didn't he? Because aside from his work, his blogs clearly showed that he had a deep loathing of the kind of authoritarianism of government and almost wanted to dismantle it in many respects.
Oh, he did. I mean, he was very much, he'd spent a lot of time researching things. And I think he was frustrated that when he worked for Gove, he couldn't just do what he wanted to do. and really, he sort of set out this sort of manifesto for changing government that's more appropriate for a politician than for somebody who's a ministerial flunky, which is in effect what he was. But he became very powerful, and a lot of his agendas actually survived because it was incorporated into a government reform program. So, you know, he's a very influential figure. And a lot of people
don't
controversial.
Really
have, yeah, very controversial.
Very controversial. And so really, your article is about how Dominic Cummings is the power behind the Boris Johnson throne of lockdown. And so a lot of it portrays him as very central and very manipulative. Can you expand on that?
Well, I mean, really, what I was trying to sort of get at without being too in your face about it with this series was that he was kind of the useful idiot. So he was the last line of resistance to getting to Boris, because the person that I think was actually really behind it was Jeremy Farrar, who was the head of the Wellcome Trust, and he'd managed to sort of wiggle his way onto the SAGE expert advisory group. And Farrar was also one of the founding members of CEPI. And it was CEPI who, behind the scenes, were pushing for lockdowns, because the whole concept of a lockdown for a public health emergency was developed by CEPI's now CEO, a guy named Dr. Richard Hatchett, who was former head of the American BARDA agency. But what became apparent when I was doing this series on Cummings was that Farrar did not have enough support on SAGE for this lockdown. He wanted it. This was their shakedown of last resort, because governments just weren't stumping up the money that they wanted for CEPI's vaccine program. So kind of like mafia bosses on the side running a protection racket. And it's like, you know, the pandemic's going to ruin your economy and you need to lock down, and let us bring in our miracle vaccines and it'll all be well again. It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But it became very clear that even from what Cummings has said, there was very little support on SAGE, who was supposed to be the official advisory. So I started kind of interrogating the witness statements that had been given by Cummings and some of his close advisors who he brought with him from Vote Leave. Because we have an ongoing COVID-19 inquiry at the moment. So I was looking at that, and it became very apparent that it was Cummings who started to panic, and he was the one who had bullied Boris Johnson into the lockdown, with a little bit of help from Macron. I think that was kind of the final thing, was when the French threatened to close the borders and starved.
But all it was across, evident. But it was evident something had happened, though, because Boris Johnson went from this much more sort of libertarian approach to C19 and lockdown, and suddenly he was as draconian and totalitarian as the rest of them. So something definitely happened, right? And so Cummings was clearly instrumental in that. And I'm just reading part of your article here where he was talking about his thought process. He said people were coming to him around 25th February, and they were saying, America is completely screwing this up. You should be really aggressive. And those are like interesting keywords, aren't they? I think that sort of prepares us for what was then to come.
Yeah. And so he first said that when he appeared before Parliament in May 2021. And I thought, who are these very smart people who started approaching you on the 25th of February? And it turns out it's somebody who's actually just a random bloke on the internet, but that Dominic had become friends with over, because he'd discovered this guy's blog and decided he was a super forecaster who'd predicted the 2008 housing crash. And Dominic is all into super forecasters. So, you know, it was peculiar. It's like, where is this drumbeat in the middle of February? Who is he talking to? Because it's a bit concerning to think that people outside government who have no business having any influence on our policy are able to kind of get in there and agitate things in this way.
Absolutely. We're going to go to some news headlines, but when we come back, let's start talking a bit more about those cast of characters who seem to have had incredible influence over our nation in 2020. We'll be right back.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Show them how it's done.
Let's go.
I got news for you.
News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran announced that it had launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel on Saturday, originating from both Iran and the locations of its regional proxies. This assault, which Israel claims was largely thwarted with 99% of the projectiles intercepted by Israeli, U.S., and allied forces, represents the first direct military strike by Iran on Israel.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
And we are back. I am delighted this morning to be joined by Paula Jardine. And Paula, I should say, you are here by special request. A number of our viewers wrote in and said we had to get you on, including Paul. Good morning to you, Paul. We are now talking about the people who had undue influence on a British Parliament during C19 and were involved in enforcing lockdown and all attendant measures. Let's talk about the Warners, Paula. Tell us about the Warners. Yeah.
So the Warners are they're two brothers. They're both PhDs, bright guys. Worked with Cummings on the Vote Leave campaign, and Mark Warner, the older brother, has a company called Faculty AI. Cummings is all about AI and anything kind of cutting edge science. He's all in on it. And he credits their, because a faculty worked with a company called Cambridge Analytica, and they have ties to Google DeepMind and various other people. So they're kind of entrenched with all this deep state AI tech stuff. When Cummings went to number 10, he brought Ben Warner into number 10 with him as the digital and data special advisor. And meanwhile, Mark, the older brother's company, had been hired to do a digital transformation project for the National Health Service, because Dominic Cummings has had a bee in his bonnet, apparently, about the NHS killing people. Digital transformation and checklists and various other digital tools was his solution for the NHS not killing people. Because apparently people get tested for X, think they have X, and then run off and kill themselves, according to Dominic. These two brothers were very instrumental in kind of pushing Cummings into backing the lockdown. And it seems that on the 27th of February, Ben went to Patrick Vallance and said, oh, I don't think the NHS has a COVID data dashboard. So by the 6th of March, his brother's company was setting up a COVID data dashboard for hospitals. And then Cummings says, well, on the 7th, Mark approached me to tell me that his spidey senses were telling him that the official government plan, which was really much business as usual, was completely wrong, and the NHS was going to be overwhelmed and collapse. And because it was his two trusted advisors who were telling him that the official plans were wrong, he'd already preconditioned himself to be predisposed to listening to them, because he'd spent years talking himself into a state where everything in the government was rubbish and it was going to collapse in the next crisis.
Right.
So you had a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. And part of the official narrative about the UK lockdown was that Neil Ferguson was largely responsible for lockdown based on his modelling. And many people believe that it was Sage who were behind that. But it turns out that it was the Warners, right?
Yeah. So and behind the Warners, you've got Valance, Sir Patrick Valance, who was the chief scientific advisor. And he, I think, was Farrar's man inside government, because they're planning for this whole Manhattan project for biodefense, which I've written on extensively, goes back probably to about 2015. This has been in the works for a long time. It didn't just materialize out of nowhere in January 2020. So you had Valance and Farrar, and they were pushing at an open door because they were saying all the things that Cummings loves to hear. Oh, we can run this Manhattan project for vaccines.
Right
up his alley.
Absolutely.
So he was just an easy mark.
He was, and it was a lot of control freakery taking place there. But one of the interesting things I think that I found moving forward to come out of your series was how this enabled COVID to advance his own projects. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah. So in the March 2020 budget, he'd been given £800 million for his advanced research project agency. I think they called it ARIA. And it's modelled on the 1950s American DARPA project, which emerged from the Manhattan Project for the nuclear bomb. What's notorious about the DARPA project is, I mean, they finance things like the internet, but it's kind of a cheat's charter because it's all military-run programs and there are no standard accounting procedures whatsoever. And people just kind of, you know, you've lavishly funded to go off and do these absolutely mad research projects. And he wanted this as an innovation incubator for British science here. But he wanted all the same things to apply, you know, no application of government procurement rules. along comes this pandemic. And once he'd got himself, people had him worked up into this excited state. It was like all the things he wanted to do, which were to trash the hiring rules and the accounting rules, the procurement rules. He was off and running and just so blinkered that he's not cognizant at all that he's been manipulated at all in this. The trajectory was determined in advance and he's just going along with it. And it's a perfect opportunity to roll these things out with an even bigger budget.
Right, absolutely, an even bigger budget. I mean, some of the figures that you mention in your articles are absolutely eye-watering. 47.8 billion worth of contracts awarded between March 2020 and March 2023, of which PPE accounted for 14.7 billion. PPE, some of which was largely unusable. And there's so much going on. And of course, Dominic Cummings was also, of course, behind the Orwellian test and trace system as well. I mean, it just goes on, doesn't it? He's everything that we are concerned about when it comes to AI and deep data, I think. Right, Paula?
Yes. And it brings out this whole COVID thing brought out the authoritarian in him because he saw no problem whatsoever at trampling over GDPR rules for data sharing. I think the line on his blog that really had me just kill me now was when he complained about the testing, NHS testing people and telling them you've got a disease because you've tested positive. And what does he roll out? This lavishly funded, ludicrous test and trace program. And this is all the stuff that the security intelligence service people wanted to do for anti-terrorism stuff back in the Blair years. And it was all stopped on civil liberties grounds. And I've not seen a breakdown of how, because they spent nearly $23 billion on test and trace. Well, how much of that went into the IT infrastructure? And this is the bit that survived because it's part of his government reforms program. So you look and it's like, well, we're going to have a single point of access for every person and all the government databases are going to be interoperable. And it's creating this digital panopticon. And he's just been oblivious to all the pushback from the civil servants saying, look, this is really dangerous from civil liberties perspective. I was like, no, these guys are telling me this is how we need to manage a pandemic, a public health emergency. And you just realize how dangerous he is or was because he was just so blinkered and didn't. I think he showed very poor judgment and he had very tunnel vision. He had his project. He thought he had the prescription for how to fix government. And this was his opportunity.
Thank you so much for not only writing this series of articles, Paula, but for joining us this morning. Very much appreciated. Everybody, this is journalist Paula Jardine. Her series of articles, How Dominic Cummings Pushed Us Into Lockdown, Parts 1, 2 and 3, is available on The Conservative Woman. Thank you, Paula. Very excellent work. We'll be right back.
From weather and traffic reports
to news of political developments,
we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives. They face exponential risks and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
Absolutely.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked at the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre, surtout que je m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with the free press.
Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
My character Shazam knows all about growing up in a family full of teenage superheroes. They're bold.
Where's everyone going?
To fight crime.
Okay.
Adventurous.
Shazam!
There's never a dull moment. And no matter what happens, they'll always have your back. All they need is a place to grow and be themselves. And the best part is, you don't have to be a superhero to adopt a teen. Learn more about adopting a teen from foster care. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward.
You're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
You are indeed. Mogden says Johnson was warned or his family was threatened. Yeah, because something definitely changed. And Just the Bloke says Cummings is and always was a master manipulator. Anybody remember him in the Rose Garden? Very unusual. This was after he had allegedly broken lockdown rules, headed up to his home. And then he ended up giving a press conference in the Rose Garden at number 10, which is absolutely unheard of for a political advisor to be put front and center the way he was. And that was when many of us knew that he was much more powerful than it would first appear. Now, I am delighted to be joined by a regular commentator on this show, Geoffrey Peel, editor of The New Era, geopolitical commentator. And Geoffrey, good morning to you. Wonderful to have you with us as usual. I'm looking for some wonderful analysis. So the Labour Party seemingly on course to win the general election later this year. We're going to be looking at what role the situation in the Middle East has had on them electorally, and also how George Galloway is utilising this very fully to his benefit for the Workers' Party of Great Britain. But first, First of all, Jeff, when I talked to you yesterday, you were talking about the new narrative that is forming in the Middle East. What did you mean by that?
Well, obviously, the tide has turned a little bit against Israel, and even the mainstream media, to an extent, has cottoned on to this. You know, I noticed that when the so-called attack by Iran, the cruise missile attacks and so on against Israel, was being covered heavily by the BBC. There was much less coverage, for example, by Sky, and it was interesting that. David Cameron was interviewed on Sky News and was saying, you know, had we not intercepted these missiles, you know, so many casualties could have occurred in Israel. And the response from the Sky interviewer was, well, why did you not intercept all the missiles that have been fired into Gaza by Israel? You know, so this kind of narrative change is happening apace, and the BBC response, you know, the shock and awe kind of response in terms of the Iranian attack, I think isn't being reflected by other media organizations that realize that the tide is very much turning. Popular opinion has gone against Israel, and within Israel, I think popular opinion is going against Netanyahu. So there is this sort of subtle change of narrative, and they're desperately trying to claw back the agenda by focusing on this Iranian attack. You know, there's another interesting snippet this morning on Twitter where somebody noted that the cost of intercepting these missiles probably amounted to about, I have no idea how they came up with this number, but $1.3 billion, because they were using state-of-the-art technology, but when, of course, most of the missiles that were launched by Iran was ancient technology with no hope of actually ever penetrating Israeli airspace. So it's become very nuanced, and the response has definitely changed in terms of this Iranian situation.
But it is interesting, isn't it, that our legacy media is looking at this in slightly different ways than usual. I mean, of course, there is still that absolute, you know, dominant fear that we're all feeling. It feels very intense out there, Jeff. I mean, actually, even though I am experienced and skilled in this game of media, I've even, to a degree, been driven by what they're saying, because it's terrifying.
Mm. Yeah, it is. And of course, it has to lead the agenda. It has to be saturated, you know, in order to get the message through. And I think that's been another change, in that it would appear that no matter how many sort of saucepans and frying pans and everything they throw at us, you know, in terms of getting some of these messages across about how we should be really afraid about the escalation of war in the Middle East and how this could potentially turn into World War III. It's not really having as much impact as it did, for example, during the early days of COVID, you know, because I think most people are becoming much more cynical. There was a video that did the rounds in the early stages of COVID about what percentage of the population is sort of instantly hypnotized by propaganda. And, you know, I can't remember the number, but it was something like 30% or whatever. But now we've become more accustomed to these shock and awe tactics. I think a greater percentage of the population is less inclined to believe the narrative. You know, I think most people believe that everybody within the establishment is lying to them. Now, they might differ on the nature of the lies, but I think we're getting to the stage where they no longer really can control the news agenda in the way that they did, because there is just this inbuilt cynicism and exhaustion from the, you know, the onslaught of nonsense that has been coming our way. But I think most people are cottoning on to this.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? And one of the other things that you said was to me that this appeared to be designed to have NATO defend Israel against aggression. So once again, it is whipping up sympathy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think there's an interesting a Twitter account called DD Geopolitics, and their focus is on how there's a sort of multipolar dimension to all of this. You know, it seems to be that the agenda of the elite has accepted the fact that there's going to be a multipolar world, you know, and that, so this is the sort of second iteration. First of all, it was about the Western onslaught, WEF, the World Health Organization, a sort of unipolar world, inflicting all of the nonsense, the COVID nonsense on us. But now, geopolitically, it's becoming a bit more nuanced in that these power blocks are being presented to us. You know, so you've got the power block represented by Iran, for example. You've got and Syria, and then you've got the power block represented by Russia. And of course, then Putin comes out yesterday and says that, of course, he'll support Iran, you know, should this escalate. So it's almost as though they're saying, you know, we now recognize that there are these power blocks that are, you know, entitled to their own autonomy to a degree. But then I think what the plan is, they'll join them all up and they'll say, right, you have to conform, you have to agree with what we collectively agree, you know. So suddenly the G20 and all of this nonsense will come into play again. So we're definitely, the narrative is morphing, and the sort of Kissinger multipolar approach to world politics is coming into play increasingly.
I mean, I do find it all interesting, and the analysis of it from, you know, commentator to commentator is equally as interesting. So how is this all impacting the UK? Because obviously we know from earlier this year, George Galloway, commentator, TV radio presenter, politician now, obviously, well, always has been actually, but has recently been reinstalled into the Houses of Parliament after his win in Rochdale. So he's now giving Labour, and I think predominantly Labour, a run for their money, right, over this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, and when he was elected, of course, we had the weird address to the nation by Rishi Sunak, and you're in front of Downing Street. You know, the Conservative Party was so spooked that they felt that they had to have an address to the nation, where, ironically, they were suggesting that George Galloway's election by a huge majority was in some way a sort of you know, reflex response into sectarianism and racism and tribalism or whatever. But of course, that's exactly the point that Galloway was making. You know, you're using these tribal arguments, putting Muslim against Christian, you know, black against white, etc. at every opportunity, vaccinated against unvaccinated. Now, Galloway was a wee bit suspect, I have to say, during COVID.
He
was
terrible.
Tended to lurch towards authoritarianism in a way which was highly ironic, given the fact that he was saying that sectarianism against the Muslim population was inherently wrong, and obviously the treatment of Gaza by Israel. But the fact remained that it was a wonderful victory, in that it was a great slap in the face to the Uni Party. And of course, reform on the right couldn't respond at all, because they were kind of stuck in that uni party mold of tribalism. And what Galloway managed to do is to say, well, actually, we're not in a world where one group of people should be ostracized and vilified constantly. People are decent regardless of their race or background or color or creed. And they tend to behave in very decent ways and have a respect for people who are, you know, having this onslaught inflicted upon them by Israel in Gaza. And I think that resonated very, very well. And of course, he's not building on that. I think he's building on it in a very inappropriate way, because essentially he's creating a Muslim party run by an aging white Scotsman, you know, so it's very weird. And, you know, he's just announced a candidate who will be running against Angela Rayner, Aroma Hassan. But again, it's weird that he's had to go for a sort of sectarian argument in order to counter the sectarianism and tribalism that's constantly being whipped up by the Uni Party. So that's a bit unfortunate. But the fact remains, he's a catalyst for change within the left. And I think what we need now is a catalyst for change within the right, because reform has completely lost it. You know, you had that embarrassment of, you know, Richard Tice having his trip to Ukraine and not drawing attention to the fact that this, this war, this proxy war, was being paid for by massive money printing. And, it was a campaign that had no popular support whatsoever. Yet he feels as though he needs to conform to these tribalist arguments in order to win support from the right. That's no longer the case. I think most people, right, left, wherever, see that we're being stitched up by an establishment that just doesn't listen.
Well, exactly. And I'm wondering whether George Galloway is targeting the seat of Angela Rayner, because she's currently a soft target. Obviously, she is potentially facing police investigation regarding her home sales. And so do you think it is because she's a soft target in this, or it's something else?
I think she is, to a degree, because obviously of the housing issue. You know, she was apparently living with her husband, or not. We're not absolutely sure. That would be subject to the police investigation. But but she certainly had a second home, and then she sold it, and obviously claimed that it was her primary home, and therefore not subject to capital gains. So that's sort of the subject of the potential police investigation. But it's a kind of, it's not a major misdemeanor in the scale of things. You know, we've just had that discussion relating to Dominic Cummings and the fact that Conservative MPs were running around doing dodgy little deals in terms of getting PPE contracts and so on with their mates. You know, by comparison, that is significantly worse. But of course, Galloway is a career politician. He knows how to play the game. He knows that this is going to be Rayner's Achilles heel, and he's going to play on it. You know, and also it creates a very, very bad aura when you have a Labour MP doing grubby little sort of financial shenanigans and pocketing a few quid. So therefore, he's obviously going to play on it. But it does make it clear that, you know, Labour Party, Conservative Party, Reform Party, whatever party is sort of establishment focused, they're all going to be engaging in the same tactics for personal gain. And frankly, you know, that shouldn't have been what she was focused on, you know, making a few extra quid from a house sale. And he'll take advantage of that. And I think he'll do very, very well and have the Labour Party worried. But we need more of the same on the right.
I think one of the reasons why people are focusing on Angela Rayner is because she's such a virtue signaler, isn't she? She's so virtuous. And the problem is that when you come off this way, we expect the Tories to be involved in grubby little deals, don't we? We generally do. But we don't, for some reason, we don't expect that from Labour. And in the same way as we expect Labour to be supporting Palestine and what's going on. And of course, Keir Starmer is not doing any of those things, absolutely, clearly on the side of Zionism, so it would appear. So I think, again, George Galloway has spotted an inroad there, right? The weakness at the top of Labour.
Yeah, and yes, you're right about Zionism as well. You know, it permeates everything. You know, I was at a Bitcoin-oriented conference over the last few days, and it was all about freedom and financial freedom and so on. But there was a kind of strand of Zionism even pervading that, you know, in that a lot of the organizations and think tanks and so on that are feeding money into startup businesses in the sort of new decentralized space, that money emanates from these think tanks that are funded ultimately by organizations and individuals who are highly pro-Zionist. And you know, it gets absolutely everywhere. So you're absolutely right. The Labour Party's roots, obviously, is in support of Palestine and anti-Zionist. So at what point did the Labour Party capitulate? At what point were they paid off? Mm-hmm. And has there been a systemic funding program for Labour Party MPs to say the right thing and stay on message relating to Israel? I don't know when that happened, but it's weird in the extreme. And Galloway is absolutely right to draw attention to it.
He is, Jeff. Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, lending us your expertise and insight as ever. Greatly appreciated, everybody. This is Geoffrey Peel, obviously a geopolitical commentator and the editor of The New Era. Take good care of yourself, Jeff. Have an excellent week. Thank you for your time this morning. And thank you, Jeff. Take care. We will, of course, be right back after 9 o'clock, after the news headlines. And we will be joined by Alistair Williams, the world's most cancelled comedian, apparently. apparently. And of course, TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, will be drilling down on Iran and Israel for us. Do not go anywhere. We will be right back.